Hello and welcome to the Money, Mind, and Meaning podcast. I am your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby. So I not only host a podcast, the one you're listening to, but I've also appeared on a number of podcasts. At my latest count, I have been on 47 podcasts and radio shows in the last year or so promoting my book, The Laws of Wealth, which I hope you have taken the opportunity to check out. So on a recent podcast, I was asked a fascinating question that really gave me time to stop and think. And the thing that I was asked was, what was the biggest financial mistake that I had made in my own life? And I thought this was a great question because I spend a lot of time lecturing other people on how they make stupid mistakes with money and how they're so fallible and irrational and whatever with respect to their financial behavior. But I thought it was cool to have the interviewer turn this back on me. And I said with very little hesitation at the time and would still say today that the biggest financial mistake that I've ever made was buying a big house. You know, 2 years ago, we moved to Atlanta, to suburban Atlanta, and bought a very big house. And that hasn't been a great decision. And so today on the podcast, we're going to talk about why people like me all over the place, when you get that thing that you wanted, why it's not satisfying. Because I'm a house guy. I mean, I love architecture. I love real estate. I love picking out finishes and everything that goes in a house. I'm a homebody, so I spend a lot of time at my house. I work from my house. So you'd think when I, you know, buy a big, beautiful house that it would be very satisfying. And the crazy thing for me has been we love Atlanta. We love our neighbors. We love where we're at. And yet the whole thing has still been kind of disappointing, and it hasn't been what I thought it would be. So we're going to talk about that, dig into my own psychology perhaps, and get to why when we attain that thing that we've always wanted, why it doesn't seem to be quite as satisfying as we perhaps would have dreamed. And to do this, I want to start by talking about one of my favorite topics, which is religion. And in specific, we're going to talk about Buddhism. Because Buddhism is a little different. Because unlike most religions that are founded around sort of a central god or goddess, the central figure of Buddhism is in fact a man named Siddhartha Gautama, who made some really shrewd observations about human nature and the human brain. So Siddhartha was born into royalty. He had inherited a small kingdom by the age of 29. So having acquired at a young age what many people spend their whole lives striving for, he became aware of his own discontent as well as the unsettled nature of those around him. Young and old, rich and poor, dissatisfaction seemed to be the common thread uniting all of humankind. So Buddha, as he later was called, observed that when we are in lack, we long for days of greater prosperity and fulfillment. But when wealth and plenty and big houses arrive, we quickly become sated and long for an even more intense experience. So the Buddha's great insight was that human suffering was less a case of godly displeasure and more an inability to control our own minds. So as he saw it, suffering occurred when our selfish craving and desire bumped up against the inevitability of pain in the world. So Buddha may have lived over 500 years BC, but he correctly anticipated one truth about the brain. When it comes to money, we, like Hamilton, are never satisfied. So part of this frustrating mirage is anticipating reward is deeply satisfying, whereas actually receiving the reward is far less gratifying. So imagined rewards have no ceiling. And they don't come with any of the headaches of actually hitting it big. And so we take great pleasure in building castles in the sky and discussing what we would do with, say, our lottery winnings. As Jason Zweig says of this concept, quote, "By the time you pocket the money, the thrill of greed has faded into something that resembles a neurological yawn, even though you got the gains you wanted. Making money feels good, all right. It just doesn't feel as good as expecting to make money." I could relate this back again to my house dilemma. Planning for buying a house, scheming and dreaming about this with my family was absolutely satisfying. But the reality of a bunch of bathrooms to clean and a big mortgage payment and a big income tax payment, or property tax rather, payment every year, not as much fun. So if left unchecked, our natural mental processes are a formula for dissatisfaction. We long for wealth, but when we get it, the appeal of what we've spent so long hoping for quickly dissipates. Psychologists refer to this struggle as the hedonic treadmill, and it's what leads us to try and fail to keep up with the Joneses. So we're all familiar with the term keeping up with the Joneses, but it's doubtful that we understand just how deeply ingrained this is in our concept of success, and how the neurological processes we've touched on in this podcast contribute. So each year, Gallup, the survey organization, asks Americans to determine what is the smallest amount of money a family of four needs to get along in your community. So Gallup finds that the answers to this question moves up in line with the average incomes of the respondents. Enough, it seems, is a moving target that our flawed psychology won't quite let us scratch. The amount of money we need to survive is always just a little bit more than we have right now. So in developed nations, the notions of relative wealth and relative poverty are very much at play. Now there is absolutely legitimate want in developed nations. 1 in 5 American children are food insecure on any given day. But among the middle and upper socioeconomic classes, people tend to look to others to determine whether or not they are successful, rather than pointing to some static measure of wealth. In fact, studies show that the most noticeable way in which money impacts happiness is negatively. We see that the very rich enjoy a slight bump in happiness, given their comparative financial superiority, but the have-nots are absolutely miserable as they look up at their better-resourced counterparts. So given that the increase in happiness is slight, and that the rich make up a small fraction of the total population, in general, the tendency to view money in comparative terms is the source of a lot of misery. So given our tendency to compare our own incomes with what others have, we only feel better off if we move up relative to those with whom we compare ourselves. Thinking of wealth creation in this comparative light, it becomes a contest where your gains are tantamount to my losses and vice versa. In this paradigm, my striving for a greater income and working longer hours has decreased your happiness in aggregate. In a very real sense, we're attempting to climb to the top of the corporate ladder, a ladder of success, on the backs of those with whom we interact, when we view it this way. And in so doing, we are sacrificing a great deal of what would actually make us happy along the way. Given this all too human tendency to compare and construe wealth in relative terms, it's easy to see how the work-life balance we are constantly looking to achieve continues to shift increasingly toward work. After all, if we take a break, the people with whom we are comparing ourselves will be that much further ahead in the race upon our return. As long as work remains a you win, I lose scenario, our relationship with our fellow human beings will be strained at best as we continue to push past each other in the direction of greater and greater stress and imbalance. Our brains push us toward comparative notions of financial well-being that only provide transitory joy, but understanding our limitations is a first step toward making a different choice. Indeed, the Western tendency toward outward displays of wealth and comparative measurement is not the way it is in all developed countries. So Switzerland, for example, is just one example of a very wealthy country with a totally different philosophy about showy wealth. The American mantra seems to be, if you've got it, flaunt it. But the Swiss take a very different approach. Their motto seems to be, if you've got it, hide it, so as not to provoke envy in others. The Swiss approach demonstrates that our views are an outcropping of a specific way of viewing wealth and success rather than something deterministic about human nature. We are not our worst impulses, and it's up to us to determine to support each other on the way to balance and true happiness rather than prodding each other toward jealousy and excess. So Daniel Kahneman famously helmed a Princeton study that set out to answer the age-old question, can money buy happiness? And the answer was sort of. Researchers found that making little money did not cause sadness in and of itself, but it did tend to heighten and exacerbate existing worries. For instance, among people who were divorced, 51% of those who made less than $1,000 a month reported having felt sad or stressed the previous day, whereas the number fell to 24% among those earning $3,000 or more a month. So having more money seems to provide those undergoing adversity with more security and resources for dealing with their troubles. However, the researchers found that this effect that mitigates the impact of difficulty, really began to taper off around $75,000 in annual income. So for those making more than $75,000 a year, individual differences, so sort of your own psychology, had much more to do with happiness than money did. The study doesn't make any specific inferences as to why $75,000 is the magic number, but I'd like to sort of take a stab at it. So for most families who make about $75,000 a year, they have enough to live in a safe home, they can go to send their kids to a decent school, and they have adequate leisure time. So once these basic needs are met, quality of life has less to do with buying happiness and more to do with individual attitudes. After all, someone who makes $750,000 can buy a faster car than someone who makes $75,000, but their ability to get from point A to point B is not substantially improved. So it would seem that once we have our basic financial needs met, the rest is up to us. So I hope some of the stories and statistics I've shared today have been helpful for you. Learn to run your own race. Learn to realize about yourself that all the things you're striving for are perhaps more fun to dream about than they are to achieve, and that the real joy is in the journey and not in the destination. It's trite, it's cliche, but there's actually a lot of science behind it, and I hope this helps to prove it. Thanks again for listening. If you would like to support the podcast, I would encourage you to check out The Laws of Wealth, my book that I'm so proud of. Head over to Amazon, check it out. If you've already read it, please give it a nice review. And I'd also encourage you to pre-order The Behavioral Investor, my new book that will be coming out this fall. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.